Well, up next with Stephen LaChance, of course, we're going to be talking about the St. Louis Exorcist case, the Tri-County Truck Stop, the Morris Mill Hotel, and Zombie Road, and more stories in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. When I first came to St. Louis back in 1979, a couple of people came up to me and said, you do know this is where the Exorcist case really hit its peak, when they had an old hospital, the Alexan Brothers Hospital, which has since been destroyed. But it's an amazing story. Stephen LaChance with us. Stephen, it started in Baltimore, Maryland, with a little boy, not the girl as displayed in the movie The Exorcist.
That's correct. It started in Baltimore, Maryland. Why it came to St. Louis is, a lot of the information that we have on the case comes from the diary that was found in a drawer in the Alexian Brothers Hospital that was written by Father Raymond Bishop. How we know they came from Maryland, what happened was the mother had family in St. Louis. And what the mother claimed it happened was that Lewis came on the boy, welts that raised. On the boy, and she felt that it was, you know, go to St. Louis, and that's why they brought the boy here. And they originally, when they first brought him, they took him to Normandy, Missouri, which is a suburb of St. Louis, and into her family member's house there in Normandy, where that was where some of the first initial rites of the exorcism, or what they began. This journey, because it was a journey that took months for them to complete. It was through a whole winter into like April for them to complete it. But it started in the House of Normandy, and then it went to different locations from there, George. Which you've got a lot of people out there that talk about the locations. Of course, you heard Alexian Brothers. You heard the wing. It was torn down. You hear that the crack where the boys' room was in the parking lot there at the hospital still remains. Seen that. St. Xavier's Church on Lindell and Grand in St. Louis, obviously, they took the boy there because they had taken the boy to St. Louis University, and they kept him in one of the rectories there. And there's all of these locations. Everybody's got a claim to the Exorcist location. You have the old one with the Castlewood Apartments. That was once a mental institution. They claimed that he was there at one point. White Castle, retreat. I mean, there's all these places. But the interesting thing is somebody took me to a place that I had never heard of before. It was a hospital, but it wasn't the hospital that everybody would think. It was a different one, but we had to go through armed guards to get into this hospital. We were searched and everything to be let in. And then I went to go to the main elevator, and she stopped me and she said, no, we got to go into this way. And she opened a door which looked like a normal door to any room. And behind that door was a small elevator. And I got into the small elevator. It took us up to around the fourth floor. I believe it was the fourth floor. And I stepped out, and what I stepped out into was a completely deserted floor of a hospital. Jeez. And I said, what's this? And she said, well, this is where they kept a priest. And I said, well, what priest? I mean, knowing a little bit about the case at that point, I wasn't quite sure what she was talking about. But I had a feeling. She goes, look, one of the priests that was effective from the Exorcist case. And I'm like, are you saying that this is one of the places? She goes, they kept this priest here till 1983. Upon his death, on his deathbed, as a matter of fact, they claim that he tried to strangle his nurse. What they did at that point is they closed the floor of this hospital down. And it's a working hospital, and here is this floor that nothing is on and nobody is on. So I started walking down. And, you know, she was like, do you feel anything here? Do you see anything? Well, there was a day room across off to the side of the hallway as I'm walking down the hallway. And I heard, like, a tapping on the windows as I'm walking down. So I thought, well, maybe it's me walking. You know, you always try to figure out what it is before you make an assumption, right?
Sure.
Because it's usually the other thing. You know, it's my walking or it's this. I mean, you know, paranormal research can be really, really boring stuff, people. A lot of times you don't get things right away. So anyway, I went up to the glass and I put my hand on the glass, though. And when I put my hand on the glass, something tapped on my hand.
Wow.
And I put my hand down, and I was like, okay. And so there was a double set of doors at the end of the hallway, and she's telling me that the Catholic Church, you know, that they actually perform paranormal experiences on the floor of this hospital. The boy was never there. This is all about a priest, by the way. We get to the end of the hallway, and there's a set of double doors. And I want to go through those double doors, and she said, no, you can't go through that way. They said, why? She goes, because the activity behind there is pretty extreme.
I had heard, Stephen, that they even sold some of the furniture that was in the room where the little boy was kept, and that those people who owned it, they too experienced some very bizarre things.
Really? Yeah, you know, in there's still furniture from that. That is kept in the storage facility right over by Alton, I believe is where.
That's creepy. Yeah. I tried for years to find the priest. You know, there were two priests involved, and maybe.
Well, there was Father Halloran. Now, Halloran was wasn't actually a priest when he did work the case. Father Bodern.
Who was the main priest?
It was Father Bodern. Okay. Father Bishop just wrote these notes to it. But it was Father Bodern who was the main priest. Halloran was actually, he was actually in his, the learning phases. And he was actually used to help hold the boy down. Now, Halloran became famous because he was one of the first that would talk about it publicly. But he wasn't present for every single, you know, event, which Father Bishop was. The diary, have you read the diary before?
I have not.
It's interesting. You can actually Google the diary online. People put in the St. Louis diary, you know, of the Exorcist, Father Father Bishop, and it will come up. And there's actually an Adobe version out there that you can download, and you actually read it. It's very interesting. It takes you step by step. But what I find interesting is a lot of these peripheral locations that people talk about are never mentioned within the diary. So. I find that interesting. And you know what, George, how about this? How about if these other locations are put out there to keep people off track of a story that the actual locations they're keeping them away from?
That could be, yeah, maybe a diversion.
Uh-huh. You know, because, I mean, especially this, you know, this location that I was talking to you about. You know, if you go to the Exorcist film, you know, which supposedly Blatty had unprecedented...
How did he know about this case, by the way, when he wrote his book?
You know, I don't know how he found out about it. I've never looked into that. I need to look into that, though, now that you've asked, though. But I know that he came across it. I know that he had access to the diary. You know, he had unprecedented access to a lot of it. He had some inside knowledge and some inside people that he was working with. What I find interesting is if you look at the end of the Exorcist film, what happens? The demon goes into the priest, and then the priest obviously throws himself out the window. This location we're talking about a priest they kept that was affected by that case for, 30-something years?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, he probably... died a very horrible, horrible death. You know, Blatty, he's still alive. Why don't we try to find him together?
Yeah,
he's 86
really
years old. He's 86 years old. Let's get him.
Yes, sir. You know, because I would love to ask the question, did you know about this location? Did you know about this priest? And did you base that on this? Because this is a location that, I'm telling you, not many people have had the privilege or the know-how to get there. I mean, I had heard, it was one of those things that you've always heard inklings about. I mean, you know that, George. I mean, if you live in St. Louis, there's a lot of rumors that surround this case, and you always hear inklings of, and they're always like holy grail places. Well, I have always heard about a location where there was a floor of a hospital that was shut off that they actually housed a priest.
Yep.
It's like one of those holy grail things. Well, come to find out, it was actually true, my friend.
Sure was. It was an incredible case.
I just would love to hear the details. I got pictures. I'll show you pictures sometime.
And, the Catholic Church has at least 120 dedicated priests who do nothing but exorcisms. Mm-hmm. There's got to be something behind it, Stephen.
One of the priests that I worked with on my personal case came from the Vatican. His name was Father Ricardo Reese. He was actually one of the assistant, one of the assistant exorcists to the Vatican.
Does he take his job seriously?
Very seriously, very seriously. And I'm telling you what, to sit down and talk to this man who does this for a living, as a priest, in the stories that he could tell you, I mean, some of the most frightening things, probably some of the most frightening stories I've ever heard. And the thing that I get from him that I thought was the most interesting that I got from him is how many of these cases turn into suicides and we never knew that they were a demonic case there to begin with. How many people were losing and we have no idea. Mm. That's a frightening, frightening thing to me. And then we talked about it. And I work with a doctor in St. Louis. I'll send cases to. He's a psychiatrist, Dr. Chisty. And he helped us with the union case, as a matter of fact. And Dr. Chesty will tell you that, we have institutions full of people that are there for good reasons, and then we have institutions that are full of people that are there for paranormal reasons.
You know, the amazing part of this whole story, Stephen, the little boy, mm-hmm. the possessed little boy, has got to be around somewhere now as an adult.
He is around as an adult. He is around as an adult. As a matter of fact, he lives a pretty normal life. They keep him pretty much hidden. His name and stuff is known now. His name is Ronnie, and he was actually a rocket scientist. He worked for NASA.
Really?
Yeah, he sure did. I mean, he doesn't remember any of it.
None? Has he been interviewed about this?
Well, I don't think he's ever actually been interviewed, but, family members, when we were working on Haunted Boy, when I was doing some of the research there with the Booth brothers, they did a lot of research where they actually got to talk to some of the family members of him. But he's never came out publicly and talked about it. Now, you want to talk about a coup. That would be a coup to be able to get that gentleman to actually talk about it. But then again, if he doesn't remember the story, I mean, how much can he tell?
Right. To get him and Blatty on at the same time,
would be
the author
amazing.
Of the book.
Yeah, would be amazing. That would be a show to end all shows, my friend.
You know what? Let's work on it. We'll get you back to co-host it with me.
Absolutely.
And that would be one heck of a program. My God.
Gosh, a lot to discuss there, a lot to be uncovered. And, the thing is there's so much urban legend that surrounds it. And, but the thing is I found that every time I go out and I want to prove urban legend, right, that this is urban legend, that I always end up in the eye of the storm some way. I mean, it's always where there's smoke, there's fire, and this is definitely one of those cases.
Now, tell me what you think happened on that day when they tried to exorcise this boy in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a scenario.
Well, from what I understand, it was in the hospital where they did it. He was having difficulty all day long, from what I understand. At one point in the day, normally he would act normally during the day, but this particular day was very bad. Now, what I understand from the case file from Father Bishop's notes is that the boy claims that St. Michael came to him. And St. Michael was actually what freed him. Now, I've also heard different stories, too. Now, I've talked to people that were actually in the room that the boy was in at different times. And one of the things that I find consistently they all talk about is where the bed would have been, at the head of the bed, there is a black, charred circle. like thing there. So it's interesting, you know, did the demon come out and did it go that way? But, you know, what I believe to be true from what I know and from the locations I've been to, you know, the boy may have called on St. Michael, St. Michael came in, but I think that when the demon left, the boy went into the priest.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the priest got hit and got hit bad. He probably didn't know it right away.
Right.
But then eventually it got to him.
Yeah, and that's who we fast forward to 1983, and that's who we have dying in the floor of this hospital all by himself with no other patient there but him.
How about doctors who might have been witnesses to that day?
Now that's something, that's a way to go to it. It would be the doctors or the nurses.
They got to be in St. Louis. People generally don't leave St. Louis once they're there.
Right. If just the nurses that worked that day or the nurse that was at his deathbed will come forward and talk to us. That would be the key to the case.
What if somebody recorded the actual screaming of the little boy?
Well, you know what? I don't know. I've never heard any recordings of it, of that sort of thing.
They must have recorded it.
They had to record something. I would imagine there's recordings out there somewhere of something. You know, I mean, we're talking the late 40s. I mean, reel to reel, it should have been done.
8mm film, had to, maybe.
8mm film, yeah. I mean, there's stuff out there like that should exist that I've never come across. I don't know if you have. But I would be very, very interested to see something like that, or to even hear something like that. Because, you know, if it exists, I think somebody's probably sitting on it pretty, pretty solidly.
That's your next book, by the way, Exorcist Revisited or something like
the next book is about living in the city of the Exorcist. I mean, I moved to South St. Louis in May, and I pull up. The real estate agent, you'll love the story.
My daughter just moved there too.
Yeah, I pulled up to this house. It's down off Broadway, so I'm living in the neighborhood of the Exorcist, right? I said, well, great. I look up at the house and it looks like the Amityville. So I look at the real estate agent. I said, great, you're giving me the neighborhood of the Exorcist, knowing that I've lived through a haunting like this, and now you're wanting me to move into the Amityville. And so I moved into this 100-year-old house, and everything's good. So
you like old houses, don't you?
I didn't. Well, I did earlier. It took a lot to get me to go back into one. It really did. I mean, right after the haunting, you know, I went through a series of, okay, I'm going to live in new places, right? And then the thought hit me, well, where were they getting the wood to build the house? You know, it's, you're being ridiculous. So I talked myself back into the older places with character. And in St. Louis, we have such great architecture and such great homes that how could you not, you know?
Absolutely. Now, tell me about a couple of your works, the Uninvited and Blessed Are the Wicked, which are about that screaming house you lived in.
Well, The Uninvited, I wanted to tell the story finally, and a Discovery Channel did one episode of a haunting on it called Fear House, and it was really kind of the Disney version, so I decided to tell the story, but I wanted to do it in a way that nobody's ever really done it before, so I did it as if you were sitting in the living room with me and I was telling you the story. When people read the book, they very much feel like I'm there with them, and that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to give it from my point of view because, I mean, my kids lived through this and there's other people. I wanted to leave that open for them if they ever wanted to do it. So I go from the beginning, actually beforehand, you know, the things that happened to us as far as divorce and all of that goes, so you understand the state of mind I was in when we get to the house. And then I cover, you know, living through the house, living through the haunting. The family that I went later to help, while I was still attached, I mean, we were trying to help each other, really. The possession, the oppression, all of that. And that's all covered in The Uninvited, which The Uninvited is very much the journey into the dark. And then Blessed Are the Wicked came about because the family came forward with the evidence and the history of the house. You know, and a lot of times people think, you know, Lorraine Warren told me once. She told me that, you know, a haunting is never over.
No, never. Stay with us, Stephen. We're going to come back. Much more to talk with you about, including, of course, the Tri-County Truck Stop. How about Morris Mill Hotel and Zombie Road? That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, you know, this holiday season, if you're looking for something really different for yourself and have some fun, and you know what, when you invite your friends and family over to the house for Christmas, play this CD, Holiday Magic Coast Style, which you can pick up. Coast to Coast guests, we all donated our time and our voices and our energy to help out some veterans charities as well. Simply go to our website. You'll look at the holiday CD in the highlights reel. You can't miss it. It's a great cover. You click that. Down at the bottom, it'll take you to Amazon.com, and you can order it, get it in time for Christmas. And listen to folks like Joshua Warren, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, Lionel Fanthorpe doing what he does, Pat Boone, UFO Phil, Whitley Strieber, so many other people, Jim Paris, William Henry, me, and even a special guest that you're going to hear singing with me. Just go ahead and pick up the Holiday Magic Coast Style CD by going to CoastToCoastAM.com. Welcome back. Stephen LaChance with us. Stephen, let's pick up by talking about the Tri-County Truck Stop in Villa Ridge, Missouri. What's going on there?
One of my favorite hauntings. 2006, it was when I first came in contact with it. I came in contact with it as actually as a teenager because when we were out on Saturday nights, we usually ended up there for breakfast about, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
One of those all-nighters, wasn't it?
Yeah, those all-nighters when you were young enough to do those like that. But it was years later. It's 2006. A waitress from the restaurant knew that I had been working in the paranormal and doing this sort of thing, came to me and she said, would you come to the restaurant? It was a truck stop restaurant. Restaurant out in Villa Ridge, Missouri, on old Route 66, by the way.
Yeah.
It used to be the old Diamonds, actually the original Diamonds in the location. It burned down at one point. Then it became the Diamonds, and then the Diamonds obviously moved out to 44, and Tri-County Truck Stop was left, to give you a little back history. But I said, well, what's going on? Well, she said she was claiming that a lot of the female employees were being touched, hair pulled. A lot of plates and stuff were being broken. And this was, I found, really fascinating. Young boys, for some reason, were claiming that they were seeing, now, a couple of them described it as a man that was killing a woman with a knife on the stairway that went upstairs to the trucker rooms. Another little boy described it as he saw the boogeyman. Killing a woman on the stairway, which I imagine any child seeing that kind of scene would think it was the boogeyman. But I found that kind of disturbing, and it's what got me there right away because it was bothering me that these children were being affected. I mean, remember, that's how I got involved, because my kids were being affected.
So. Sure.
So I went to Tri-County Truck Stop. Immediately in the truck stop, I mean, it was loud, it was noisy, it was a restaurant type of atmosphere when I got there. For the investigation the first night. And I was looking over at the counter, and I saw a coffee pot start vibrating. And it was vibrating, and it shot off the counter and slammed into the floor, Meg, obviously, with a crash and commotion. And then everything stopped. I mean, all the noise that comes with a restaurant, everybody just kind of stopped and froze. And so, you know, the noise started building back up and building back up, and the next thing, here goes a plate, crash. Well, it became interesting because after doing a lot of research and then looking at the truck stop through many different ways, one of the hauntings in it was something that didn't like noise, and so it would make these things happen so it could get just a moment of quiet. Now, what's interesting, when I started into the research, there was a truck driver that had died of, well, actually, he had OD'd on an 8-ball that he had taken.
No, in his truck he died?
Well, he died in the middle of the restaurant.
Oh.
He died right at his breakfast table there. With the old waitress was still there, by the way. Actually, she wouldn't tell you too much. She would just, it was funny because when I was working on the case and getting the different pieces of the history, I would go to her and I would ask her something, and she wouldn't give me the information, but if I got the information, she would go, yeah, that happened. And that was about all she would say, you know, so I imagine she had a lot more secrets. But there were different things. There was a woman that actually ended up there at one point that they believed was murdered. There's a lot of reason to support this. There's a lot of background to it. There's even police reports that lend to it that how she was trying to get away from her abusive husband. There's so, and that could be, we think, who could be being killed on the steps of the Tri-County truck stop there. Because of people coming forward. You know, when you get into small-town America, you got to kind of get in there, and they got to know you to open up. And since I grew up partially in Washington, Missouri, that's how it happened. And I would be sitting in a restaurant, and people would come up to me and go, "Did you hear?" And so I had a rule. It was, you know, unless I had to hear it three times, and I had to hear it from three different sources, so before I would consider it being real. Because there was so much there. Now, there was you'll love this part of it. There was a man who actually lived in the basement of the restaurant. It looks like a basement. He came back from the Korean War, it is believed, and then his wife and his son were actually died out on Route 66 in a car accident. He lived in the basement there, and he would throw things at people when they came downstairs. at any given time, if you got into, and as a matter of fact, they even talked to, he would actually throw feces at people. But the interesting thing is, so we have a reporter down there from one of the local newspapers, and they're doing a story on it. And here, guess what comes flying? You know, we knew he threw things. And we'd heard a story that the last time they saw him is when the ownership was taken over by somebody else, and the owners came in and they asked him to leave, and he threw a knife at one of the new owners. Well, when the reporter was there, here comes this rusty butcher knife flying across the room and lands at her feet. And I don't think she'll ever do anything paranormal as far as a story goes ever again, because it terrified her. But I found it interesting that he always throws, he'll throw light bulbs, he'll be down there and light bulbs will be thrown at you. So I do believe that that's him downstairs. There's also a story of a prostitute that lost her life right outside there as well. I mean, there's a lot of different suicides that can happen.
Do you think most truck stops have stories like that, or is this one unusual?
I don't think it's unusual. I think any place with a high transient aspect to it, I mean, when you have people coming, you know, like a hotel, I mean, you know, we see hospitals, hotels, that's schools. You know, I mean, look at all the places that we find that are haunted. Why wouldn't a restaurant that served a national clientele that came in and out, I mean, famous people, why wouldn't that be haunted? People come in and things happen. People bring their own baggage with them into these places. I think because it's transient, I don't think it's unusual for it at all. I think we'll find, you know, that there's a lot of places like this out there just for that reason. I don't think it is unusual in that sense. I think the haunting itself might be.
What about the Morris Mill Hotel?
Morris Mill Hotel. Actually, it was Herb Exer's first went into it. You know, urban exploration, and they had some things happen to them in there, and they said, well, it was haunting. We were going to do a little film to show people that, you know, you can go out and do your own film if you want to, and, you know, and share things with people. So the Morris Mill seemed like the likely place. No investigator had been into it before. Now, the Morris Mill Hotel was ran is a hotel, and he was there for years. I mean, the James gang, Jesse James, I mean, is on the books. Clara Bow, Charlie Chaplin, Charles Lindbergh. Actually got a photograph of Charles Lindbergh outside. He's standing outside of the Morris Mill Hotel that probably no one's ever seen before. You know, it's a very Al Capone. Capone did a lot of stuff there. But the most interesting character out of the Morris Mill is Bertha Gifford. Now, if you know, those of you that don't know who Bertha Gifford is, she is considered, that could be possibly one of the first recorded female serial killers we ever had. She would kill her victims by feeding them arsenic in different things. Like, I'll give you an example. There's these two sisters that she murdered, that she rolled their candy in the arsenic. Or she would powder her biscuits, because she was a really good cook. She would powder her biscuits with the arsenic. And it's believed she was running the hotel with her husband, her first husband, and it's believed that is where she murdered him, and he was probably her first victim, is what they think. She thought that she was the angel of mercy Now, I got to tell you, George, I spent a week in that hotel without electricity, without anything. And you know, at 5:30 in the morning, every morning, you hear coming across the floors. And you come across the floors and then down the stairway. You hear the sound of what sounds like high heels.
That's an amazing story, too.
Yeah, and I've never, you know, you always hear footsteps, right? You always hear footsteps, and you always think, well, you know, that's great. But you actually, these are high heels. The first day we were in the hotel, one of the girls that came with us, she was scratched down her neck, three scratch marks on her neck. You know, there were certain things, you know, it's a haunting that you got to be real careful with. And I kind of worry because they kind of run some tours through there that it might not be the best thing because it can get kind of violent because I actually was with a gentleman during part of this, and I actually seen a 6'2" guy get picked up and thrown across the room in the morning.
How far? Just boom.
He went about 6-7 feet, you know, and I mean, it knocked him down.
I bet he ran out of there after that.
Yeah. That was the last, you know, that was one of the last moments I spent at the hotel, by the way. I don't go looking for that kind of thing. You know, but, you know, in different investigators through the years since then, I mean, we were the first in, but, you know, each investigator that comes adds something to it, but you hear that story quite a bit. I mean, there was one gentleman. Now, this guy I talked to, because he told me he was going, and I said, don't mess with it. You know, don't be mean to it. Don't provoke it. Guy went in and provoked it. It slammed him up against the wall, held him there, shut the door, and wouldn't let him out. They found him on the front porch of the hotel, and he spent the rest of the night on the front porch crying. You know, so that's the kind of building this is. You got to be careful when you go there. So those of you that will go, just beware that. Make sure you protect yourself really, really well.
Stephen, let's move on to Zombie Road. What can you tell us about this place?
The Zombie Road I went to. Now, there's one of the urban legends. I heard stories about this urban legend of Zombie Road. It's out in Eureka, Missouri. It's a little bit west of St. Louis. It's Old State Road in 109. You know, there's a little children's train station out there now. But Zombie Road at one point was used for the trucks to take the gravel from the river, and they would take it to the different areas, and they needed a way to get the gravel out, obviously, because the Merrimack River runs right along Zombie Road. So that's what the road was there for. But however, during the years, different stories and different things. Now, they call it Zombie Road. Now, some people will tell you it's because there was an escaped lunatic from an asylum that would go out and kill people, and his name was Zombie. There's really not a whole lot of indication. That's more urban legend, I would say. Really, what I got down into the research of it, I found that Zombie Road was more of a tagline for the kids. You know, they would be in front of their parents and didn't want to know their parents didn't know what they were doing and say, well, I'll see you at Zombie Road. That means let's go to Lawler Ford Road, which was closed. And let's party, you know. So, you know, that's the story. However, so I thought, well, I'm going to go prove this urban legend wrong. So I go down there, and on October, and it's raining, and it's going to be a walk down through the woods, but this is going to be fun in the dark with flashlights, you know. And I thought, well, it's going to be, you know, it's probably going to be like Pooh's 100-Acre Woods, but it turned into the Blair Witch Project. This place has the most amazing shadow figures you'll ever see in your life. And one of my good friends, who's now passed away, his name's Tom, Tom Halstead, took the famous photo, which shows the shadow figure standing on the ridge at Zombie Road. And then there's a puddle down beneath because it had just rained, and you don't see their reflection. Now, the interesting thing is they're about 4 foot tall. So there is some history about a bus crash there and that sort of thing that could lend to that. But, you know, I went down there with the Booth brothers in 2007 to see if we could film them. And we took we had a thermal cam with us, middle of the night, 3 a.m. in the morning, we're out in the middle of Zombie Road. All of a sudden, it gets cold. I mean, I'm talking cold. We saw the smoke started coming out of our mouths. And these shadow figures started stepping out from behind the trees. We have, you know, probably some of the best footage of shadow figures we ever caught was for the film Children in the Grave I did with them. But they start stepping out from the trees, and I'm not talking one or two, George. We're talking about 15, 20. And they're standing there, and you can feel them looking at you. And you're surrounded in the middle of the woods in the middle of the night where nobody can hear your scream. Think about that.
That's scary.
Yeah. It was. It was probably one of those moments. It was one of those moments you catch yourself going, why am I here and why am I doing this? I mean, you know, because that was the thought. Because it's like, you know, I can deal with one ghost or two ghosts at a time, maybe, you know, but when you're looking and you got 15 and 20 of these things around you, that's a different story.
I had the Booth brothers on with me back in 2010. They did Spook TV for Sci-Fi, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did.
One of the things.
They did Spook for Sci-Fi, which they did the Waverly Hills, and then they did Children of the Grave for Sci-Fi, which Zombie Road's part of that as well. It's part of the same Spook series.
You must love doing what you're doing.
I love what I'm doing. You got to look at it. It started out as a bad thing, you know. With your family affected and living through what I lived through. However, I've been able to take it and turn it into something positive, and I think that's what you need to do in life. I think when you come across something that really just knocks you to your knees, you need to get yourself back up, and the way you do that is you look for the good in what has been given to you, and that's what I try to do.
Now, your organization, you've got a paranormal group in St. Louis, don't you? A research society? Tell me about that.
St. Louis Paranormal Research Society. I had started the Missouri Paranormal Research years ago and then left it. And then when I moved to St. Louis, though, I wanted to get involved with the group. Now, this group's been around for 13 years. They do the Lent Mansion. We do the Alton, the Haunted YWCA in Alton, and all of the different things, and they're really into the history and research behind the hauntings, and that really fascinated me, and that's why I finally, after being such a rogue and by myself for so long, decided to join with a group and do some work with a group. And we've done some really great things in the past year, you know, like the Fox Theater, the Lump. We got, you know, other things like that coming up that are, you know, good, strong buildings. And the idea is to start telling the history of St. Louis, the haunted history of St. Louis, I mean, really, and start exposing people to it. Because we have so much out there that, you know, when you talk about St. Louis that we're missing. The People's Hospital, you know, the Peabody Opera House. I mean, I can go on. I mean, the Ivory Theater in Carondelet. I mean, there's a church in Carondelet I was just at the other night, which is a Lutheran church. There's so many of these haunted buildings that are not being, that people aren't going into, that people really don't know a whole lot about. And the idea is to bring that to the forefront.
Well, great, and you do bring that to the forefront indeed. So, Stephen, what's next for you? What are your next projects?
Well, writing a book at the point, this point.
That's a lot of work.
On the most haunted neighborhood in America, you know, some of the stuff that we were talking about there. The journey of living in St. Louis. I'd like to write from, you know, a personal point of view and give the people that personal story. You know, it's a diary type thing. So it'll take me a year or so to get it done. But, you know, and then I'm working on another thing that I'm working on is just, this is purely historical. St. Louis has more schools in its vicinity that are closed than they actually have running. Now, these schools actually are some of the most architecturally fantastic buildings you have ever seen. And so I'm working on putting a documentary together on these schools and going into, like, the Grover Cleveland School.
Well, that's a great idea. Hey, Stephen, we're going to take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.